From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 2 months ago in Albany as lawmakers were continuing to grind away at the New York State budget. It was late, and a big reason for the weeks-long delay was, at least in part, the debate over Medicaid spending. Governor Hochul proposed cuts and changes that some lawmakers felt would impede New Yorkers' access to health care. Well, health-related issues have always been a big focus of the work that has been done by Assemblymember Josh Jensen, who represents District No. 134 in the New York State Assembly. He's our guest this hour. We're continuing our series of conversations with local state leaders about the budget, what's in it, what is not, the biggest disappointments, the biggest wins in their eyes. They'll answer your questions, and they'll talk about what they are working on next. Assemblymember Jensen, welcome back to the program. Thank you for being here.
I'm happy to be here, and I appreciate spending an hour with you and your listeners, Evan.
Well, let me just start with where we usually start, which is, you know, did anything disappoint you or was it a perfect budget?
I mean, I think the entire nature of state government, especially for a minority party member
handling
such as myself.
Disappointment.
Yeah, it's, you know, it is interesting. I think with the budget, you know, it's always a matter of degrees because certainly there's things in the budget that I can be very happy with. But oftentimes they're in a sandwich with things that I am a little bit more unhappy about. So there was a bill that Harry Brownson sponsors. It's a SUNY PLA bill, which would guarantee project labor agreements on capital projects on SUNY campuses. I'm a co-sponsor of that bill. He carries. Very happy to see it move. Was looking forward to voting for it, but it got included in the budget and in a budget bill that I had to vote against. So, you know, it's, you know, and I try to be very conscious about, especially when there's funding projects and things that happen that are funded through the budget, and I vote against that budget bill, not to take credit, but to applaud that its inclusion while understanding that it was in something that, you know, I wasn't so happy to see included. But $237 billion budget, there's going to be highs, there's going to be lows.
All right. Is there a single thing in there that you look at and say, I can't believe we did this?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing you talked about in the intro and with serving as the ranking member on the Assembly Health Committee, it was the state of Medicaid and especially the MCO tax, which is a tax on managed care organizations that we're utilizing as a state to pay for Medicaid increases for hospitals, nursing homes, and assisted living providers. And I'm very uncomfortable with using that funding stream is the way to get those dollars flowing.
Why not have an MCO tax?
Well, I like to call, and I called it multiple times on the floor, it's legalized federal money laundering. It's essentially we're going to tax managed care organizations. In the budget, we aim to tax them at $4 billion. We already taxed them $6.5 billion through HICRA tax. And so we're going to take that $4 billion, or whatever the number ends up being, put it up to the federal government, CMS, ask them to match it at about 150%, get that money back, give them back their money with a little bit of thanks for doing business with us, and then use the rest to fund Medicaid increases. If we knew that there was a guarantee, that'd be one thing. But we have to apply through the federal government. Only one state, California, currently has an operational MCO tax in the same way. And the Biden administration approved it begrudgingly. And they've said they don't want to do it anymore. They're looking to close the loophole. And we have a presidential election coming up in November where the administration may change. And I would think that that loophole could very well be closed after January 20th, regardless of who's in the White House.
So I know this gets a little bit wonky and down in the weeds, but that's partially why we do this. I mean, I don't know of many venues where you get a chance to talk to someone at length, and all of our local lawmakers tend to come in and do this, and we are grateful for that. And so, yeah, we get a little wonky, but that's part of the service here. So let's kind of explore this a little bit more. I think what this is about with Medicaid is how much does the state spend on Medicaid? Mm-hmm. What's the mechanism to pay for that? And how much, you know, do local governments have responsibility for? I think counties in this case with Medicaid, but there's a local takeover, right?
Yeah. So, you know, counties have a huge obligation. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but last year in the budget, the state intercepted that money. And the state likes to say that it's actually saving counties money. You talk to counties, they don't necessarily agree with that because they still have to meet the obligations without that direct revenue stream. And what worries me about the MCO tax is that if the federal government doesn't grant that waiver, there's no inherent plan B because we're using the revenue that we get from that to fund those Medicaid increases, which is why for the first time and since I've been in the legislature, we didn't do a rate increase. We did lump sums because you don't get that money unless we have a way to pay for it. And there's no plan B that in all likelihood, we're going to have to take that out of reserves, which we have very robust reserves in the state. And I know the governor's really focused on that, but we're going to have to take those reserves out. It's going to happen at the end of the calendar year. And it only provides more uncertainty for healthcare providers who have lived in an era of uncertainty for the past 4 years since 2020 and how their operations were affected by COVID.
So let me give you the keys to the castle. Now you're in the legislative majority.
Yeah.
And they tell you that as the ranking member, you get to do whatever you want with Medicaid.
Yeah.
How much does the state spend? What's the mechanism to pay for it? How much and what do you do about counties and that local burden?
Yeah, so the state spends in total $101.9 billion in Medicaid, and $66.2 billion of that is federal funds that come in. Out of our general fund, New York's spending about $35.7 billion, the second largest amount of allocated money after just a couple, hundred million underneath public education funding. What I think we really have to do in the terms of Medicaid, and this is something that I call it my tilting at windmills Don Quixote, is we have to fix the entire Medicaid system. It's massively inefficient and ineffective. When you have providers, whether they be dentists, pediatricians, who are able to pick and choose who they treat based on who's paying the bill, that in and of itself is going to make access more difficult. I was at a assisted living home earlier this week. They want to bring in a dentist for the Medicaid payers. It costs a dentist $286 an hour to treat. Medicaid reimbursed them $25 an hour. What dentist is ever going to walk into that facility without somebody else coming on making up that difference?
$261 an hour.
Or even another $150 just to make it a little bit less onerous. In punishing, I've talked to pediatricians that if they take 31% of their payers as Medicaid, they lose money and they will struggle to keep their practice open. So you have an unofficial cap, in a lot of pediatricians' office about how many Medicaid payer sources they can have on their books. Whereas you look at a hospital, they have to treat whoever walks in the door, regardless of who's footing the bill. But yet we have other providers who are able to pick and choose. And I think with Medicaid, we have to look at, and this is what I would do if, I was ever the chairman of the health committee, is that we need to right-size the system. We have wealth screening for Medicaid that is almost like scout's honor. You self-report your income, that's checked against your most recent tax filing, and then the state accepts whatever's the lower, even if it's not what's verified on your tax filing. The state could enter into a contract with CMS where the federal government picks up 75% of the bill. And when somebody applies, they'll look at what the last payroll data was for that person to deem eligibility. So I think we need to look at ensuring that those who are most in need are the ones receiving Medicaid. For higher levels of income, let's push them to the next step up, which is the Essential Plan, which has 11.6 billion dollars in it and is entirely funded by the federal government. They put $5 billion in it this year. And then for people who are next up on the income levels but still need a little bit of help, let's encourage them to get health care either through employer-sponsored plans or through the state of health marketplace. I was really happy in the governor's state of the state that she announced that she wanted to look at premium assistance. When she made the announcement, I was working on legislation to do that exact same thing. She made the announcement, and then we never heard about it again. But premium assistance, if you pick up 10% of the cost for 300% of the federal poverty level, 10% of the premium cost, that may make employer-sponsored plans and buying on the marketplace a feasible option for people. My hope would be that we can right-size our public assistance programs in health. We can then find a model where we can make Medicaid more efficient, and we can reimburse at higher levels of cost of care. And in a perfect world, I'd like us to get to 100% reimbursement for cost of care. So that way, when somebody walks into a dentist's office, it doesn't matter if you're on Medicaid, the Essential Plan, MVP Exalis, that dentist knows they're going to get paid for the care they give, and you don't have to worry about whether or not your provider can actually cover take that insurance.
What's the best argument against your plan?
Costs a lot of money. And it also creates, it would cost a lot of money if you don't right-size the system. But then there's a lot of politicians in both parties who are worried about a benefits cliff, that you could push people who may be getting subsidized assistance off a plan that they may be very happy with. But that's why I'm saying you're not dropping people from the plan. You're just putting them on a place where they belong based on what their actual reality is.
Are you concerned about a benefits cliff?
No, because it's if we were just sitting and say, okay, we're going to take 25% of our Medicaid population and just drop them, that'd be one thing. But we're just saying, let's go from Medicaid to the essential plan.
Okay. So in any way, in other words, mitigate the possible cliff.
Well, and that's, and I think you can do other things too. And I have a bill, you know, I was concerned that the New York Health Act was going to move this year. So we came up and,
That's essentially single payer at the state.
Single payer and Medicaid for all. And I was concerned because it would cost about $250 billion to implement. So it'd be twice the state budget. It would have the state completely take over private health insurance, which the state struggles with being able to set up a legal marijuana marketplace. We want to have them overseeing all the insurance. I don't know if we're quite ready. And so working with some of my colleagues in the Republican Minority Conference, we came up with a Real Choice Health Act, which would help get us from 95% coverage to 100% coverage, so get that 5% covered, and would only cost around $1 billion. But it would create a cost containment commission that would actually look at ways we could bring down healthcare spending without politicians being the one making the decisions. It would allow for health savings accounts to be ubiquitous. So that way people could have more money to those, you know, either co-pays or other things that may pop up throughout the time. And allow people to buy on the marketplace outside of enrollment periods, that if somebody gets shot, they can get access to that whenever, or that you can sign up when you do your income tax filing. You can check a box to say, listen, I want this to be screened to see if I'm eligible for Medicaid, the essential plan, or something else.
This is a state, obviously, where Democrats have a lot of control in state government. And so listeners who hear about the New York Health Act, single payer, might wonder, if Democrats have control over all of the branches, then why hasn't this gotten done? One of the reasons is, take, for example, Joe Morelli, who's now in Congress, of course, but used to be a majority leader for Democrats in the Assembly for many years. He did not favor single-payer health care at the state level because he said it should be a federal issue. It should happen there. And other Democrats have pointed privately to me and said, look at Vermont. It's the size of Monroe County in terms of population. They were going in the direction of single-payer. They pulled the plug, and their Democratic governor said it was because of cost. So part of the reason that there hasn't been more momentum for the New York Health Act is because Democrats have their own divisions over it.
Yep.
Although I don't know how cohesive Democrats are today. It sounds to me like part of your point is when you invoke the rollout of marijuana and you're saying, like, if we're struggling to roll out a marijuana marketplace, do you want health care?
Yep.
Do you think that that is a fair comparison? And do you think that essentially everyone should be concerned about how efficient or inefficient government would be in this?
I think it's a fair comparison because we're taking something that, before, whether illegal or legal, it was something that the state didn't directly control. And we took all the private operators and we put them into a licensed system by the state with state oversight on the day-to-day operations, which the New York Health Act would then say, we're going to eliminate all private health insurance. So MVP, see ya. Exalis, see ya. All the people who work at those places, time to go find a new job. And we're going to put all the health care under one umbrella, and it's going to be New York State doing it when we already struggle to make rational, coherent decisions on the Medicaid program, which we saw with the CDPAP reforms. And I'm doing air quotes when I say that.
I mean, I think I know where some of those people could go work.
Well, probably for the state. Probably for the state. But it's also now you're having to onboard 20,000 new state employees, which we do need a robust state workforce. But now you're having to have 20,000 people figure out an entire new way of doing things, and people need health insurance immediately. There can't be a phase-in period.
Yeah, and so one other question on this. Keith, I'll grab your phone call in a second, and we're going to be talking with Assemblymember Josh Jensen about a lot of issues. In a moment, I want to ask about where things stand with issues that you and I have talked about in past years, like early intervention funding, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot to talk about here. But my observation on why sometimes the public gains some momentum for public takeovers of, I mean, just take RG&E. So our community, of course, is having this debate. And once again, Democrats are not cohesive on what to do about this. But there is, I think there's a sentiment in the public, and I got a little bias here because, you know, in my household, RG&E is not all that popular at times. You go like, why is this bill like this? And why can't you explain this to me in 3 minutes in a phone call? And why do I feel like, you know, there's a bait and switch? And so the customer service isn't great. And so people wonder, well, is the grass greener if the public, if there's a public takeover? Similar to, I mean, most of us can think of either ourselves or family members, a loved one who's had cancer, and you sit there and you spend hours saying, all right, we're on a high deductible. If we go to mid deductible, you know, what's monthly? What does that look like? Is there long run saving? What about a lower deductible? What's the best plan? And you feel like you still, it's hard to parse. And ultimately, you don't really feel like the insurance company is all that interested in you finding the right answer. And so you go, well, maybe the grass is greener in a public takeover. Can you understand why the public has some of those sentiments to begin with?
100%. And I think that it's always, especially if you have an adverse experience, there's always going to be that frustration that wants to drive that, well, there has to be something better, almost through exacerbation. But when I talk to people, you know, in the public health world who have experience in the Canadian single market, the British single healthcare market, is that they're pissed. They're just as upset. sorry, I didn't know.
They're just as angry.
I didn't say the whole thing, so I think we're safe.
I think you're right.
They're just as frustrated with wait times and unclear justifications for why some things are picked up, some things aren't. And so they're living through the same exacerbation and frustration, but from the other side. And so that's why I think instead of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, let's look at common sense ways to make things more efficient and more effective. And, you know, since I got elected in 2020, I've always tried to paint myself as somebody who's solutions oriented. And I'll work with anybody who wants to move the ball down the field and get closer to the end zone.
All right, let me grab Keith. He's been waiting to jump in. Not sure what the subject is, but hello, Keith. Go ahead.
Evan, how you doing?
Good, sir.
I just want to preface this. Every time you have a state politician, I always try to call in, and sometimes I can't. But since I'm sitting in traffic, I figured I'd give it a shot. The gentleman, the representative, somewhat remiss that you guys couldn't override the governor's veto on the non-compete. Nothing more stifles innovation and job creation or non-compete agreements. That's why they want to eliminate them on a federal level. And if you look who was pandering to the governor, it was Wall Street. It was a financial market. And I just think that's important. The second question I'd like to ask this gentleman, do you know how much the state owes, how much New York State's debt is right now?
Yes, I do. See, my notes I was prepping. our state debt right now is $64.4 billion.
What do you mean no?
Check again. It's closer to $162 billion.
Well, we also part of that part of that is the state is the guarantor on the MTA's debt. So if you look at just the debt that the state itself has incurred, we're at 64.4, but we're also the guarantor on the MTA's debt. So that's where we could get that extra 100 plus billion because we foot the bill if the MTA goes bankrupt.
Well, I never hear any politicians saying what they're going to do to it. And ultimately it gets increased.
It went up three. We're doing $3 billion in debt service alone this year.
That's the interest, correct?
Yep.
Or is that the principal?
No, that's the interest.
All right. But don't you think that's a waste of money? I mean, I hear no plan from either side or either person on how we're going to eliminate the debt. How many people are in this state versus how much does each person owe?
I mean, 20 million people. I'm not good with math, but 20 million people and $64 billion in debt. Quite a bit. And I think, Keith, to your point, I'll lump myself into this next comment, is I don't know how to eliminate pay down $64 billion in debt in one shot or over a period of time. And I think too, politicians at every level of government struggle with hard things, and that's really hard. And I don't know a way to do it without drastically cutting our state budget into uncomfortable levels.
But I just hear you say you want the state to pick up Medicaid expenses, but the state can't print money. It doesn't matter if the county residents pick it up, the city residents, the town, or the state. It all comes from the taxpayer.
All right, Keith, let me let Josh answer that, and I can't in good conscience keep you on too much longer. You sound like you're on the side of a NASCAR track. Please be careful. Go ahead.
And I'm not saying we should drastically increase our Medicaid spending. What I think we need to do is we need to right-size the existing system. And I'm not saying throw billions of dollars more at it, but let's take the money that we're already spending, that $35.7 billion, and let's use it in a way that is more logical. And using things more logical doesn't necessarily mean throw more money at it, but let's take the money we're using and figure out a better way to do it.
Would your system for Medicaid cost less in the long run?
I would like to see that through other mechanisms. If we're talking about cost saving, I think a cost savings commission where everybody in the healthcare ecosystem takes a little bit of a haircut, I would hope that that would bring down plans, especially if we can get more people off of Medicaid, out of the essential plan, into private insurance, that would also bring down the cost for the government.
Okay. And let me also just kind of like extend on Keith's point and say that I am not an expert in government debt. I am not an expert in exactly dollars and cents in terms of, you know, what we need to do to be solvent or healthy. I mean, nobody wants debt to begin with. $64 billion sounds like a lot of debt. And you're right. There's not going to be a plan to pay it off in 1 year. If you're only paying interest and not principal, I don't know how you ever pay it off.
Right.
Is that fair?
I think that's fair. And I think it's not just our debt in New York State to be concerned about, but you look at the federal debt. I think that's even more. I think we're up in the trillions at this point.
Yeah, we are.
I think that's even more worrisome as a private citizen that we have the federal government that's carrying that debt load, especially when it can be purchased by actors who may not have the best interests of Americans at the forefront of their decision making. So I think debt's an issue. But I don't think any level of government really has a sustainable mechanism to figure out how to pay it down in one fell swoop.
Let me just make a mental note. A separate program, it'll be the wonkiest connections ever. We'll just talk about government debt at different levels, what it means, what the ramifications are.
Ivan, I don't want to be on that show unless we're talking about Everton Football Club's debt. And then I'll join you for that one.
Listen, there will be no slurs. There will be no slandering of Everton football on this program.
Up to the Toffees.
I will not. Yes, thank you. I will not brook any slander.
I'm an Everton fan, so that's
okay.
That's a safe place.
We're down there. Let me also hit Keith's first point before we move on to some other topics. He brought up non-compete agreements.
Yep.
I know the federal government was on that. I don't know the latest from the federal government on non-competes. And I'm not even sure if that went to the Supreme Court.
I know we passed – I'm trying to think when we did it. We passed it in the legislature, and I voted for it as somebody who had a non-compete. When I worked in PR, I had a non-compete. And so I don't know if the government vetoed it. I honestly can't remember. But on the topic of overriding vetoes – I think it should be something the legislature should do more of, especially when we have the governor vetoing bills that pass unanimously or near unanimously. We are a co-equal branch of government. What is wrong with us coming back and saying, listen, we disagree with your decision to veto this. We think this is responsible public policy. We're going to override that veto. I don't see a problem with it. I wish we did it. I wish we ever did it. But certainly that's, you know, the speaker and the majority make the decision on whether or not we come back to do that.
Do you agree with Keith that non-competes stifle, I think he said innovation, that they're negative to begin with?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't love signing one when I had to, just because it limits your options, and that's why I voted for the bill. Because I think that we want to talk about free movement of labor. We want to talk about the ability for people to excel and choose their own path. I think there does have to be protections on if you're involved in projects where it's, you know, something that's patented or it's a...
But that's pretty narrow.
Yeah, and it is. I think there... But that's why I think non-compete saying that you can't go work, you know, you work for a Wall Street, you know, for an investment bank, you can't go work for the investment bank across the street. I don't think that that's, you know, I think a non-compete's different than somebody saying, you know, you're going to work in PR. You can't try to recruit one of our clients for a year, 18 months. I think that's different. But saying that you can't work in the same industry, it's, I think that's problematic.
Keith, the National Law Review says that the FTC has a new rule banning most, not all, but most non-compete agreements that will go into effect on September 4th of this year. So we'll have to see what most means in practice and if there is more need to address that. But there you go. That's from the National Law Review today on the subject of non-competes. Thank you, Keith. Jane next in Rochester. Hello, Jane.
Oh, hello, Evan. How you doing?
Very good.
Great. I just turned in a few minutes ago. Unfortunately, I didn't get everything, but I heard the words cut Medicaid. And I just want to remind everybody about COVID and how, of course, Obama had plans, you know, for some epidemic, and that was thrown out. And we had, I think, an incompetent person in office presidentially. But I'm thinking if we go just the bare things, and we get caught again by surprise for something like COVID, what in the world will we do? I just don't like cutting it. And we could just simply use, like Japan does, preventative care. I mean, they spend, from what I understand, a great deal of money on preventative care. And I think from what I hear, some of that is pretty good in our state. But to go in that direction, whatever it costs to prevent disease, instead of cutting anybody, because when you start cutting people, people can't go to the doctor, and diseases spread and so on and so forth. So I'm going to listen to the response to that. Okay.
All right, Jane.
So Jane, I'm not talking about cutting Medicaid. What I'm saying is that we need to right-size the system, and a big part of doing that is making sure that we reimburse Medicaid providers closer to what the care actually costs so we don't have doctors and healthcare institutions discriminating based on who's footing the bill. I want to right-size the system so that we can have it be more efficient and more effective. And I couldn't agree more on preventative medicine. And I think a lot of times when we talk about preventative medicine, we think about healthcare. But mental health access is a huge part of preventative care. Early intervention is a part of preventative care. And so that's why we have to have an entire system that works smoother, where you have interconnected care providers so that you can nip some things in the bud before they get more problematic and, in this context, more expensive.
Talking to Josh Jensen, a member of the New York State Assembly, let's do this. Let's take our only break of the hour. And when we come back here, we're going to come back to, not only to some more of your feedback, but there's a lot more to talk about with Assembly Member Johnson. He mentioned marijuana laws. I'm very curious to know how he feels about, I mean, I don't think he thinks the state rollout has gone all that well, but there's still questions about what happens next there. And then there will be other questions that we have. I want to get back to early childhood development, early intervention. That's been a big issue for this Assembly Member in the past. We'll talk about that and a lot more with him and answer your questions on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, it's been roughly a quarter century since a movie called The Truman Show came out. And in a recent piece, culture writer Megan Garber says, "We have not learned the lessons from The Truman Show. We too easily give up our privacy. We hand Mark Zuckerberg whatever he wants. We commodify human life for our entertainment." So what are the lessons and what should we learn? We'll talk about it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. Josh Jensen serves District Number 134 in the New York State Assembly. And as a Republican, that's often means that there's some disappointment, but they have a lot of work to do in Albany. They all do. And this is a chance to hear from him on the state budget, what's in it, what's not, what he would have liked to see in it, what he would have preferred not be in it, and then some other priorities. And to my ear, Assembly Member, you have spoken quite movingly in the past about early intervention. You've talked about your own experience, and you've talked about how New York State addresses this issue. Can you update listeners on that?
Yeah, I mean, there was some movement. There was some increase in the state budget in early intervention services. There was some recognition that we need differing rates. I know when you had Jen Lunsford on the program, she brought that up. And I think we're continuing, you know, use the same metaphor I used earlier. We're continuing to move the ball down the field. It seems like we're doing 4 yards in a cloud of dust rather than necessarily airing the ball out on this topic. And I think, and I understand because of my own experience, my son's experience with it, you know, I certainly see it through a different lens. And I'd like to see greater commitment. You know, I think my colleagues bipartisanly have been very committed in the legislature on making this a priority. And unfortunately, it's something that always seems to fall off the table.
Why? Who does that?
I think we have very passionate advocates. You know, look at the Children's Agenda. They're, you know, they've been one of the loudest voices in the state on the importance of this funding. But I think sometimes it's difficult because not every family is going through this experience where they need this level of this help. And there's not a obvious push for it because, you know, a lot of times they can't afford lobbyists. You know, I think sometimes it's about lack of access to decision makers when we get into the nitty gritty. And that's one of the frustrations I have with the budget process as a whole, is that when we get, especially with late budgets, rank and file members, not just from the minority, but even from the majority, are kind of shut out of the conversation. And that's why I'd love to see a program where we have both parties, rank and file members, as part of negotiations. We have tables for topics. I'm the Republican lead on the health table. We do one pro forma hearing when negotiations start just to check a box, and then the table never opens up publicly. I love that if we had a real open dialogue about issues that wasn't just budget hearings, but actually the negotiations were taking place in sunlight where people could see, like, this is what's important. And we gave the public who can't afford a lobbyist, can't afford access to decision makers, the ability to say, listen, this is really, really important, and this is why. Because right now you have to have these advocacy groups going member to member and hope that they can find a champion to be able to grab the right ear. And I think that's one of the frustrations with the budget process, is it's not always clear why certain decisions are being made.
I think this is one of the most frustrating things to New Yorkers who often feel like the process is not transparent, or if they don't have power, then they're going to be forgotten. And often the families who have kids who need early intervention don't feel like they have a whole lot of power. They feel a desperation sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so when they hear that Republicans and Democrats are aligned, that there's a lot of agreement, that there's a lot of open and public acknowledgement that this needs to get done, they get optimistic that, hey, finally we're here, we're heard. But then all of a sudden it's not in the budget, it doesn't get done, and you look around going, well, I don't know, was it the governor, was it someone? And that's very frustrating.
Well, and that was frustrating for early intervention. You look at a program that would provide school meals, free school meals for all public school students. I'm on the bill to do that. There's bipartisan agreement in both houses. Not a prior, doesn't make the final budget. You look, we had bipartisan calls for reforming EMS in the budget. The governor proposed it in her executive proposal. It was not in the final budget. And when I asked about it on the floor debate, the Ways and Means chairwoman said it was taken out of budget negotiations at the governor's request. So she proposed it and then she pulled it. But you look at a lot of our healthcare issues, especially in hospitals, and throughput issues are completely driven by the status quo when it comes to EMS and the inability to treat in place.
Democrats have had their own issues with this governor. She, of course, is a Democrat. And that's nothing new. I mean, there are always going to be legislative and budget battles. But in the last couple of years, those issues on the Democratic side have included this feeling that they're not always getting the straight story from the governor on what's going to be in the governor's budget, what might get pulled at the last minute, why that's happening. early intervention is just one example, but it's not the only example. This year, Democrats are also very frustrated because the governor kind of intervened on congestion pricing, which is kind of this esoteric downstate issue that not a lot of us are following. But if you're a Democrat in Albany, they felt like there was so much oxygen sucked up with congestion pricing that all of a sudden they couldn't get bills they wanted to get done, some related to energy or climate, et cetera. And so it doesn't look like a great relationship to my eyes between the governor and her own party. I'm curious to know, as a Republican, how you see this governor and the work that she's doing.
I have respect for anybody who holds high government office. That I think it's very important you respect the office.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Regardless who holds it. And I think when I talk to colleagues who are in the majority from across the state, is one of their big frustrations with the status quo in Albany is they don't understand why decisions are being made.
Yeah.
Under Governor Cuomo, they would say that, and I only got 9 months with him before he resigned, but the understanding was that he was going to be just a bear to deal with, and he would be revengeful, he would be self-interested, but you could at least...
He'd tell you why?
Yeah, and you could see it coming, and he would say, he'd be very clear, like, this is why he's doing what he's doing. And I think some of the frustration when I talk to members in the majority is that they don't understand why decisions are being made, and that there's sometimes not that conversation that happens saying, hey, I'm going to do this. I'm glad you brought up the congestion pricing, because that's something very much sucked all the oxygen out of the room.
You agree with that? I mean, that's what we heard from Harry Brunson and others.
100%, because then you've got, you know, she pulled congestion pricing, which she, as early as last December, was talking about how we were going to lead it, was championing it, delayed it, very clearly for political purposes to help congressional allies of hers in the suburban communities around New York City. But the problem was that congestion pricing, that $1 billion that it was going to bring in, was what was guaranteeing $15 billion worth of bonds for MTA for capital projects. Well, that also was securing $4 billion in federal aid. So you don't have that $1 billion coming in. You don't have a way, you can't bond against an IOU, and you don't have the money that the federal government was going to give you. But the MTA still has massive capital projects it needs to do, especially for climate resilience, for making things more accessible for individuals with disabilities. And for New York City members, they've been counting on these fixes. And then the governor pulled it at last minute and said, well, we got to figure out another way to do it. So whoa. You're just announcing this at the last minute, and you want us to completely upend, find you $1 billion outside of the budget? So you want us to take a vote on a new tax on spending money out of the general fund? Like, how are we going to do this? And for somebody who represents an upstate community that could care less about congestion pricing, it's even frustrating because there's things that I was advocating for with, you know, colleagues in the majority that now those priorities got put off the side because we were going to run out of time.
Well, I promised it was kind of esoteric and wonky, but that's the congestion pricing story. I mean, even Karen DeWitt said it was a darn near scandal down there when all of this happened.
I mean, it was when you have the Senate deputy majority leader having to do press availabilities in the hallway and his hair looks disheveled and, you know, you just hold people hold up their hands being like, I don't know. It's just like it reminded me, you know, of days where you're in a crisis and it's just like, you know. And for a policy, it was a policy crisis because it was something that 5 years was in the making, was in her prepared remarks at a climate conference in Dublin or in Ireland. And, you know, 2 weeks before it was set to go into effect, after 5 years of planning, it was, we're going to delay it, which also threw fuel on the fire that she didn't cancel it. She delayed it. And I think that it shows everybody that, you know, there was probably some political considerations to help out, you know, people who were running in Long Island, Westchester, Rockland, my friend Mike Lawler, who were running the Democrat who was running against him. And I think that was even more frustrating to a lot of people, especially people in the city.
David writes to the program and says, Evan, I believe the discussion about New York State debt was off the mark. Debt incurred for capital projects is perfectly appropriate. Debt for current expenses is what is a problem. I believe that the state only uses debt for capital projects and is not allowed to take on debt for current expenses. This is not true for the federal government. That's from David, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
But I think that also, and I think that what sometimes gives a lot of pause to members in my conference is that we are, especially with the MTA guarantees, is that we're guaranteeing debt. The legislature doesn't always vote to incur the debt. So there's some constitutional questions about whether even carrying the debt load is constitutional, because we're only supposed to carry the debt that the legislature approves. And oftentimes we're not. And so that's a lot of the concern, is that we're incurring it, but we don't have a say in it.
Patrick writes to say, I really appreciate my Medicaid. I'm a small business tradesman with an LLC. I qualify for Medicaid and I do use it. My physical health is intrinsic to my career in the trades because I can't make money if my body doesn't work. Medicaid is the only perk to being an owner-operator. It's from Patrick.
Yeah, and I guess my question to Patrick would be, has he had difficulty finding providers to accept his Medicaid? Because that's the system that I'd want to get out of, where he could go to any provider he wanted to, and he would know that they would accept his Medicaid as the payer source.
Well, I'll let him email back if he wants to answer that question. He has a second prong as a new parent. He says, was there anything at all related to daycare in the budget, and what are the details? Childcare.
Yes, there was. I believe there was some incentives to provide, and this is something that we've also championed. I carry a bill on it that would take figure out a pathway to do childcare coverage for non-traditional hours. Because right now in the current system, if you need daycare from 8 to 6, there's options. Sometimes you might have to wait, but there's options. You work the B shift, the C shift, you're working overnights at Monroe Community Hospital, you need childcare, you better hope you got a family member, a spouse, or a trusted neighbor who can make sure that somebody can watch your child. So there was some money for differential hours in the budget. We also, I believe it was legislation we passed that would also allow flexibility on using some state assistance for capital projects to expand the physical portions of daycare or improve them and modernize them to make them safer, larger locations for childcare. So we've seen some incremental changes. And this is another one where we do have bipartisan agreement, maybe not on specifics, but on the idea that we have to address child care. And I think those off-hour care is something that we see a lot of agreement, because if you're going to try to have a robust economy, you got to make sure that people who work overnights have access to child care.
My guest is a member of the New York State Assembly, Josh Jensen, joining us from District Number 134. You mentioned marijuana laws and the state's rollout of the marijuana market, and there's still a lot of questions about that. In the coming months here, I think that it will be interesting to me to see what the rest of 2024 looks like for this. Because, you know, when you look at other states, a lot of people have pointed to Colorado, but not just Colorado. I mean, it's a growing number of states, probably a lot more than I even realized. Seems like every year something else comes online. And I guess the question becomes for you going forward, what do you need to see from the state? What do you want to happen in this market and what's going on?
So I think the biggest thing, and going back to when we originally legalized marijuana, is, and I had a constituent who came to me and he set up the meeting through someone else, and he was actually involved in the marijuana field in Canada and in the EU. And what he told me was that you guys are screwing it up. You need to look at it as an industry and as a supply chain, and take all the third party and using it as an equalizer. Look at it as if you're setting up an entirely new supply chain and industry. And I think if we would have done it in that way, I think we would have seen a cleaner rollout. But I think when you have the state prioritizing different demographic groups, people who may have had convictions for drug offenses, and you have differing rules and rollout times for different people, that's only adding more complications to an already complicated process. And when you have growers being able to start growing, but you don't actually have the licenses for people who have to process it or sell it, you're setting yourself up for failure, which is why we've seen farmers who have just literally tons of marijuana sitting in storage that they can't do anything with because the state didn't license the people ahead of them in the supply chain quick enough. And so they're taking huge losses on that. And even we this week or in the budget, we had to change how we're taxing the sale rather than potency and doing an excise tax. So we're 3 years from legalization, and we still can't figure out how we actually want the marketplace to operate, where I think there should have been a longer phase in. We should have had all the regulations set in place before we issued a single license to anyone. And I think that was, I think that'll be the biggest failure of this, is that we did it hodgepodge.
Is it fixable?
I mean, everything's fixable. You know, we have open heart surgery. I think right now, I think our marijuana marketplace needs some open heart surgery. And I think that, once again, I think this is where if we would have had more people at the table, and I voted against the legalization, partially because of the concerns I had about marijuana and the legalization of illicit drugs, but also because the rollout didn't seem appropriate to me. I think that there's still time, but I think you have to involve even the naysayers at the table, because they're going to bring up issues that you may never thought of when you were single-minded and moving towards a goal. And I think sometimes you need those devil's advocates at the table to kind of throw a wrench in there and say, hey, did you think about this? I mean, we still don't have legal, we don't have seed to sale tracking as a required aspect of the law. It's they can put it in place. We have it in place, but it doesn't guarantee it, which says that we're going to know where every marijuana goes from the moment the seed goes in the ground to walks out the door from a point of sale, to ensure that it's not making its way to the black market.
A couple more minutes with Josh Jensen, member of the New York State Assembly. $2.4 billion for migrant services in this budget. How much would you have liked to have seen?
I would have liked the federal government to pick up all $2.4 billion of that money.
Zero from the state.
I'd like to see zero from the state. Same thing when we have the conversation about using essential plan dollars to pick up the health insurance for migrants coming to the state. We're in this situation because of the federal government's failure. I don't think it's fair to New York State's taxpayers to have to foot the bill for something that the federal government has not addressed. It doesn't seem like it has a plan to address. And certainly, I think that we have to have the supports in place, especially if you're going to have people who are bussed without really knowing where they're going. And one of the big concerns when news reports came that of the first migrants who were coming to our community from New York City, and we had the not-for-profit sector stand up and say, we're there, we're going to support them. I think that was great. But there's also people in our own community who need that same assistance. And so that's why I love to see state taxpayer dollars go to support residents of our state, and have the federal government pick up the costs and the burden that the migrants are incurring across the country.
Do you view them as going through a legal process because they are claiming asylum?
Yep.
And therefore, you know, some of your Democratic colleagues have said you can't say that they're illegal because they're going through a legal process.
I think that it can be both. I think that you can have people who perpetrate an illegal action by crossing the border, and then their illegal action started a legal process because you can claim asylum. And I 1,000% believe that there are people who've come to this country and took any mechanism they could to get to a place where they could guarantee the safety of themselves and their family to escape persecution and violence from their own communities and their own nations. That is true. But it's also true that there are people who are coming here through illegal means, claiming asylum, who are not here for those same reasons, who are here because they want to perpetrate something else. And they're not trying to seek the American dream for their family in the traditional sense. They may be trying to seek a different American dream that may be involved in more unscrupulous methods.
I mean, what percentage do you
I have no idea. But that's also part of the problem, Evan, is that because you have people moving across the country after they enter, there's no way to track where they are. So you have people may cross the border in El Paso, and then suddenly they find themselves on a bus to the Bronx. And then they go from a bus in the Bronx to Monroe County. They're never going to get back to where they are going to be heard by an immigration lawyer or a judge to deem whether or not their asylum claim is legitimate. And I think that's part of the problem, is we never had a system in place to weed out who's here for legal means, for legal asylum, and who's here for other reasons.
Last minute or so, what haven't we talked about that you want listeners to know you're
working? Well, I think I just want to say, and I know my wife's listening, that she was very jealous that I wasn't on the show yesterday, being a big fan of RuPaul's Drag Race.
She was very jealous
that I didn't get a chance to say hello to them when she was here. So I know she would have liked me to be on yesterday to have a chance to meet them. So, no, I think the big thing, you know, I have concerns that I'm going to be interested to see how we proceed with the CDPAP changes, which is what consumer-directed assistance program for families with children who need a little bit of assistance. Mm-hmm. We drastically reformed that. We did it without really stakeholder engagement, so I'm very anxious, as are a lot of families in our community and across the state, about how the rollout to a single fiscal intermediary is going to roll out. Another wonky conversation for your listeners.
As we close here, Bob in Rochester says, you know, maybe the host and your guest should start a toffee club here in town. There, Liverpool has a club in Rochester on Park Avenue. And, of course, the Gooners always have their space. Yeah. It's hard being a toffee.
Well, I'm hoping, you know, in the budget we had basic reading initiatives, back to basics. So I hope some of our Liverpool fans who are listening can be back to basics and figure out how to understand the way it should be Premier League order.
I did not think we were going to cover that part of it. I appreciate the time, as always. And I want to say to listeners again, you know, when guests like Josh Jensen, a member of the New York State Assembly, or Harry Brunton yesterday, or Stephen Hawley the day before, Jen Lunsford, when they come on, there's no rules. It is an open conversation with you, the listener, and us, and we are grateful when they say yes. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure, Evan.
That's Josh Jensen, representing District Number 134 of the New York State Assembly. We've got more connections coming up in just a moment.